Blog Talk Radio.
Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar. Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar. Ashhadu an la ilaha illallah. Ashhadu an la ilaha illallah. Ashhadu anna Muhammadan Rasulullah. أشهد أن محمد رسول الله. حي على الصلاة. حي على الصلاة.
Inshallah, we'll be fine. So today we're going to begin our ta'lim. Today we're going to begin our ta'lim by discussing the essence of Al-Islam. And we are very impressed with the fact that we have been blessed to have an understanding. God has given us an understanding of the essence of this great way of life. Some people call it a religion, but we are told in the Quran it's actually known as a deen. Deen is an Arabic word which means a duty or an obligation. We are creatures of the Creator, whose proper name as revealed in the Quran is Allah. He's known by many names, has been known throughout history by many names, but when the Quran was revealed, we were reminded in the Quran that his name is Allah. And this is not a new name. It just occurred when the Quran was revealed to Prophet Muhammad, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, because we're told that Ibrahim, the Prophet Ibrahim, he recognized the name of Allah, and others before him recognized the name of Allah. So what we're going to do today is just to review some of the very basic information about our need to worship Allah and our duty to Allah. We know that the human being needs an authority superior to him or her to rule and life. We know this instinctively. We understand this instinctively. And we understand that we must worship something, our nature, that's created by Allah. It tells us instinctively that we must worship something, and we will never completely realize our human potential until we recognize the Creator, the one that is responsible for our existence, our Creator. And we will never completely fulfill our human potential until we recognize the Creator as that authority, because we need an authority superior to us to rule and discipline our life. And until we recognize the Creator that created us as that authority and find our true relationship with Him, we'll never fulfill, we'll never completely fulfill our human potential. I'm going to stop right now because I had some technical problems a little bit earlier, and I see that Brother Sister Imam Ali Hamza has joined us. Apologize for any technical problems, and so I just want to do a quick radio check. Are you able to hear me, Brother Ali?
Yes, Brother. Assalamu alaikum. I can hear you.
Okay, thank you. And before I do continue, I want to thank you for the fly. It's perfect. And so what we'll do is on this coming Friday, the Juma, I will ask the staff if they can get in touch with the unit chaplain's assistants or chaplains and see that it gets posted in the units on their bulletin boards. I have been told in the past by Staff Sergeant Etheridge that he would see that that's done. And so I saw him on this past Friday. I was at the chapel, but he informed me that the chief chaplain or the garrison commander had ordered the suspension of programs like our service group programs because of the anticipation of the storm. But we didn't get the storm, fortunately, but I left after talking with him about that. So inshallah, I will be back Friday, and I'll hopefully talk to him again between now and Friday, if not before Friday, on Friday, and get his support to get these flyers put up so we can inform the soldiers about the service. And also I did talk with Specialist Buell, and I think you were present then, but I also asked him about helping us with this. And if you want to use your influence with Chaplain Wilson, ask him if he'll mention it to the unit chaplains so we can get as much information out there as possible. And also ask Chaplain Buell to talk to the people over in the garrison chaplain's office. And I will, after he tells me he's made contact, I'll follow it up with them to make sure that we are in the Globe newspaper. We've been in the Globe newspaper, and I looked last week and I didn't see us being represented, so we'll get that fixed. But anyway, continuing where we left off in the discussion, know that only when a human being has the Creator as our authority in our total life, not just a Sunday service type of life or Saturday service or even Friday service type of life, with our total life, can we reach our highest potential for growth and discipline. And we all start off as little babies, creatures that are helpless, basically. All we can really do is to let our needs be known by making sounds, cries, or whimpers. And the parent, particularly the mother, but both parents and others that are familiar with the meaning of these baby sounds, will give the baby some attention to relieve the baby of whatever need that the baby is expressing, whether it's food, whether it's comfort, whether it's security, whether it's the feeling of being loved and being safe. But that's not the fulfillment of our potential. Our potential is to be active as adults. Many of us will reach adulthood and grow and make an impact on society, and there are those of us that don't reach adulthood, but we have a potential that Allah has established in us, but we cannot reach that potential until we have the Creator, whose personal and proper name is Allah, highly glorified as He, as our authority in our total life. And so in order for the human being to satisfy our narrow frame of understanding, and our frame of understanding is circumscribed by our environmental exposure, by things that we have been told, and by our limited understanding of the exposure that we've had to the environment and things that we have been told. So in order for us to satisfy our narrow frame of understanding, we constantly trying to use our tainted means improperly influenced by other things that we see and hear, that we learn about, that we are exposed to. These are tainted influencing things. So we are constantly trying to use our tainted, limited logic and knowledge to make science justify our moral weaknesses. Now we may say, how is our logic limited? Well, we know logic is the ability to reason. But if we've ever studied mathematics, we know that if we don't have a very solid foundation to base our reasoning on, then our conclusions are going to be incorrect. Now, I'm not a mathematician, but I will say this. If someone was to tell me that if I start off with zero number of stones and I want to divide the number of stones, the zero number of stones, I'm going to get 10 stones. My intuitive logic is going to tell me that doesn't make any sense. How can I divide zero into a 10 when I have nothing to start off with to do any type of division? Now, there's a form of mathematics where we get into things that are on the surface not logical, but these are things that the average person doesn't have the foundation to understand that there is logic in these things. But the simple reality is the fact that for most all of us, our logic is not well grounded because we don't know everything. And if you don't know something, it's very difficult to logically reason out that which we have no knowledge of. And so we use our limited logic and our limited knowledge to try to make science justify what? To try to make science justify our moral weaknesses. Now, one of the biggest controversial issues that's taking place in America today and probably throughout the world is this issue concerning abortion. Abortion, what is abortion? Abortion is the destruction of a life that's in the stage of a fetus or maybe an embryo, which is inside of the womb of the mother. That Allah has caused through the process of creation and conception a life to begin its existence in this place inside of the womb, or the womb. And how does that life, it gets there because the man plants a sperm, a cell called a spermatozoa or a sperm inside of the canal that leads into the womb, and it's met with a ovum or egg, and the egg is fertilized. In other words, the spermatozoa enters into the heart of that egg, and they are elements are joined together, and conception takes place. Conception meaning that the woman now begins to carry another life that is the product of this joining of the sperm and the egg. And this is called conception. And this life is planted inside of the safe place called the womb. And the woman begins to feed through the womb this new life, this new organism. And the organism grows steadily over a period of approximately 9 months, anywhere generally from 7 to 9 months, but the term, full term, is considered to be 9 months. And scientists have said that after the third month, you actually have the formation of a child. Up into that part of the developmental process, you have unformed parts. So the feet may not have distinct toes. The hands may not have distinct fingers. There may be just indistinct other parts, like the ears, instead of having the flesh is separated from the skull. The ears may be still stuck to the skull. But after 3 months, the first trimester, you can look through the sonogram or some other device, and you could see this human being still not completely developed, but you can see the outlines of this human being. But even before that, as this organism is coming into its stage of physical development, I won't say perfection because only Allah is perfect, but I will say in terms of reaching its baby stage perfection, coming into that, the life germ is being fed to the mother. And you have this little embryo or this fetus. And some women don't want to carry that baby for 9 months and deliver that baby to the world for various reasons. And so they will go to a doctor or a midwife or someone and say, abort. Stop this process of this baby coming into the world. Kill this fetus. Kill this embryo. And that's a deadly, deadly sin. That's murder. No matter how you look at it. And so the social scientists have said, well, if you catch the baby before the first trimester is over, you're not really killing a person. That's a lie. It's not true. Anytime after that conception has taken place, you have a person there, even if it's just 2 weeks later, when usually the woman can determine if something is going on, because she'll probably have some effects. She may miss a period or something will happen, changes in her body. She may have morning sickness or something will happen to let her know. And if she doesn't want to have the baby, she'll immediately start thinking of ways she can get rid of this life inside of her. That's murder. And because of society wanting to find some more, less painful way to deal with this act of murder, they come up with all of these excuses based on misguided logic. Like, the father is no good. He won't take care of me and the baby if the baby comes, or the father rapes me, or the doctor says the baby may have some kind of deformity based on something that they can see at some stage, or the family doesn't have the money to be able to take on another responsibility, another mouth to feed. All of these are effective logic that's being put to use, and it's actually Satan working on us to go against God's commandment that we shall not kill our children for want of whatever our excuse might be. And so as Muslims, we don't have any gray areas when it comes to that. We don't have any, well, in this case or that case, or perhaps in might be, no, we don't have that. We go with what Allah told us. And we go back and we look at the history of what was going on during the time that the Quran was revealed. Our Prophet Muhammad came into the world in a society, sallallahu alayhi wasallam, when it was a common practice for men who were ashamed of having female children because the male child was the one that was valued, the one that could grow up and take over the family business or help the father on the farm or in the shop or go to battle for the community, wield a spear or sword or whatever weapon that they use. And the girl was looked at as someone that didn't have much value except to be able to serve the man sexually and take care of the house and do tasks, you know, to make the house a comfortable place for the man. And so many of the men felt ashamed to have girl children, and they would take these little infants. Maybe they had not yet developed the science of abortion to the stage that it later became developed. They may have had some ways of giving some kind of poisons to the women or doing something, but it wasn't developed to the stage that it is now. They go into a clinic and they put some kind of tool up into the womb and actually tear the baby out of the womb. Maybe they didn't have that, but they would take these babies shortly after they had been born. Maybe they hadn't even gotten any feeding yet. Maybe they hadn't gotten any feeding yet. And they would take these babies and they would put these babies in the hole in the ground. And while the babies, who instinctively knew that something terrible was getting ready to happen to them, because the cold earth or even the hot earth was not the place that their nature told them that they should be. Their nature told them that they should be next to the mother's breast. And now they're in the ground. And they began to cry and whimper and scream even. And the father would take the dirt that he had taken out of the hole and he would cover the child with this dirt, suffocating the child. That's another form of terrible abortion. And this was going on. It was common. And God tells us never to abort our children, regardless. Regardless. And so, because the world has deviated from listening to the commandments of the Creator, their tainted, illogical reasoning has come up with all these kinds of excuses. And you know, I have to say this, here in the last couple of days, we witnessed what the people in the government in Florida, which is considered by many people to be the sunshine state. Most of the year, the weather is very pretty. Most of the year, it's relatively warm. People leave the colder parts of the country. I have a very, very close friend, and every year when it begins to get cold around November up in Maryland where he lives, he will travel down to his home. He has a condo, and he'll travel down to his home in Florida to spend the cold months down there because it's warm down there near Jacksonville. But look what has really happened recently. The storm has come through that part of the country and destroyed billions of property, has dismantled family life, business life. People can't even go to church today because the churches are nothing but splinters on the ground. Their homes are nothing but splinters on the ground. I was reading a story about this one family. They decided not to evacuate. They decided to stay in their home. As the waters covered the street, covered their lawn, and began to seep into their house. And the refrigerator began to be uplifted by the water in the house. And they climbed up on the refrigerator, and the water lifted the refrigerator up toward the ceiling, and the water was displacing the air in the house, and it was getting difficult for them to breathe. And the husband was able to find some type of tool, screwdriver, hammer, or something, and he banged on the ceiling as the refrigerator was being lifted up by the water, and they were both sitting on top of the refrigerator. It may have tipped over on its side, I don't know, but they were sitting on it, and the water was lifting the refrigerator up to the ceiling, and he was able to bang a hole into the ceiling, and he was trying to make the hole big enough for them to escape and get into the attic. But shortly after he was trying to do that, the water began to recede. Isn't that a terrifying experience? And people have been asking, why, oh God, you know, because they call on God when they're in trouble. This is a natural response to trouble. We get to the point where none of our devices that we try will work, and so we instinctively call on one that we know has power over all things, whether we've been praying or not. We instinctively know that. And we call on our Creator. I can say, oh God. Some people may say, oh Allah. Or maybe they say some other name, but they're calling on the Creator. And they were probably calling on the Creator. Eventually, the waters began to recede, but the house was ruined. So many homes were just splintered into nothing but shreds. People asking, today, on this now clear day down there, the weather has moved on, but the destruction still is everywhere. They're asking, why has God done this to us? Well, God has promised the people that there will be a great day and it will be a dreadful day, a judgment. When a judgment occurs, either one of two things is going to happen. Either you're guilty or you're not guilty. God doesn't have hung juries. Like, he can't make up his mind. Your self-accusing spirit already has condemned you. If you were doing wrong, you know you were doing wrong. It's like if you were doing right, you know you're doing right. There's no in between. And these people know they've been doing wrong. I won't go into all the details, but you have this great, 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 what I would say, emergence of the homosexual culture, the nudism culture down there in Florida. They have whole neighborhoods where people don't even put on a stitch of clothing and go out and mow their lawns, totally naked, and have no shame. And yet God said that he gives us clothing as a protection and as an adornment. But they have refused to adorn themselves or protect themselves. And then one thing leads to another. And so you have the gender of the eyes as they look at each other, attractions, the gender physically as they make moves on these other people because of the attractions. And they think that they won't be punished for it. Well, look what happened. Just look what happened. Maybe some of them will get the message. Maybe some of them won't. But if they don't get the message, guess what? Round two is going to come around. Maybe not this year, but next year. Or the year after. Because God is not to be played with. So we just wanted to speak a little while on that topic, and we're going to continue for about 10 more minutes. And we're going to open up the discussion. Any of you who have tuned in via the internet, which you can do if you just want to listen, we want to let you know the number to call in is 657-383-0671. 657-383-0671. But we just want to proceed for a few more minutes, because what we're talking about is YL Islam. YL Islam. Because we need an authority superior to us to rule and discipline our life. We need that. That's part of our makeup. Allah says in the Holy Quran that He created us to be daifan. Daif is a word which means weak. He created us weak. But it was not His intention for us to remain in that state. He intends for us to have a rule over our weakness and a discipline over our weakness so we can reach our full potential. But we will never complete completely fulfill our human potential until we recognize our Creator as the authority to rule and discipline our life. And we must find our true relationship with Him. And God tells us that man must come to our Creator as a servant, as a slave servant, completely submissive to His will. So many of us go wrong because we try to justify our moral weakness by using our narrow frame of understanding and our painted, limited logic and knowledge. Through the ages, as we get ready to conclude, through the ages, our misguided appetite directed our logic and led him to put his faith in things other than the Creator. I just want to take a moment and just talk about that. We all are born with human appetites. We have appetite for food. We have appetite when we get to be a certain age, 13, 14, 15, somewhere up in there, they call it puberty. For sexual intercourse or sexual relations with the opposite sex, which is that the way that God brings more people into the world. We have an appetite for beautiful things around us. There's a story in the book called the Bible that talks about the prophet Solomon, and I believe it's also repeated in the Quran, that he had an appetite for beautiful things. He had an appetite for beautiful horses. Horses, of course, you know, in that part of the world, Arabia, are one of the dominant forms of animal life. And he loved these beautiful horses. He had many beautiful horses. We have these human, some people have an appetite for power. People that want to be kings, like we have a situation right now in the United States, we have a man who wants power more than anything. He was formerly the president when it looked like he might not get reelected because of his policies, because of his personal moral defects. He said he was going to go ahead and he was going to hold on to power at any cost. They began to do illegal things, trying to hold on to that power because he wanted it so bad, and he still would like to get it again. You know, he has no limit, it seems, in his desire to have power. And then on the other side of the world, we have his, I won't say counterpart, a rival, Vladimir Putin. And he wants power so much that he will invade other people's lands to try to take over their lands and chase those people out of their homes and kill these people, including children, bombing hospitals and schools, and now threatening to kill more people with nuclear weapons just because he has a lust for power. These are appetites. And if we don't check these appetites, we can become very, very destructive and even destroy our own selves. Like people that have an appetite for sexual relations, they don't care about hygiene or safe sex, as it's called. They will experiment with many different partners, not checking to see if their partners are carrying deadly diseases. And as a result, now after many, many years where they thought they had the deadly disease of syphilis checked, now they say it's coming back. And when it comes back, because people are not going to apparently stop their activity that brings about syphilitic infection, now you're going to have children born with syphilis, deformed children, because their parents did not have the discipline to check their appetites. And all of these things are activities that we can check if we allow God to direct our lives. But when we take God out of our lives, then our appetites go out of control. And we see the results in nature. Some people are saying that the weather conditions, the droughts in the west, the floods and tornadoes, hurricanes in the east, are the result of the ozone layer being penetrated by rockets. That's probably true to a certain extent. But we have to keep God in the equation. God is not going to punish us the way he's punishing the innocent as well as the guilty because some scientists want to penetrate and go through the ozone layer to see what's on the other side. That may have some very devastating consequences, but we have to look at the fact that the consequences that we are seeing are the result of people turning their back on God, the Creator's commandments, telling us not to do certain things, and we are, as a human family, disregarding those injunctions from our Creator. So as we wrap up, we just want to say a few things. And Brother Ali, I want you to help me with something too today, and it doesn't have to end with just a discussion today. Several months ago, and I first became very, very, very ill, and I'm still very ill, but I'm stronger now than I was then, thanks to Allah. I decided that I wanted to increase my knowledge of world religions. I had studied Christianity as a child in the parochial Roman Catholic educational system all the way through high school. Part of that time I had spent as a seminarian studying to be a priest in the Catholic Church at the secondary school level. I didn't go to the college level seminary because I decided that I didn't want to be a priest, even though I did want to be a preacher. I wanted to serve God as a preacher. I didn't know anything at that time about an imam role in religion, but I knew I wanted to be a preacher. So I left and I went into the Baptist church where I could become a preacher and became a Baptist preacher, but I wasn't satisfied. There was a lot of confusion in Christianity in general. And I finally was able to come in contact with Alice Lam, and it settled my mind completely. But I still had a curiosity about some of the religions that I didn't know hardly anything about, and one of them was Hinduism. And I found out recently in this course that I'm taking in college level, of course, that Hinduism is among the top three in terms of popularity or in terms of numbers, what is called religions, what are called religions in the world. You have Christianity, Islam, and Hinduism. And Hinduism has become a global religion, just like Islam has become a global religion. And Christianity has become a global religion. So no longer is Hinduism just a quote-unquote Eastern religion. It's like no longer is Islam an Arab religion or Eastern religion or African religion. It's global. And, of course, Christianity, which originated in the Middle East, has been for many centuries a global religion. But I wanted to understand more about the one of the three religions that I hardly know anything about, and that's Hinduism. So maybe before we conclude the program today, because I'll be turning it over to you in just a minute, you can give me some insight into what the Hindus actually believe, because I believe that there's no set doctrines that everybody has to conform to. What the book tells me that I'm reading is that you have many sects in Hinduism, and different sects have adopted different beliefs, but there has to be some commonality, I would imagine, and maybe you could tell me what things are relatively common in Hinduism, because I am doing this course, and I'm at a point now where it's not easy for me to be able to take the book and get all the understanding that I'm trying to get in order to pass this class, which is what I hope to be able to do. So let me just conclude my little talk introducing Islam by saying a couple of things, and then I'll turn it over to you, Brother Assistant Imam Ali Hamza. It looked like your brother Angel had joined us for a minute, and then we had some technical problems, and he dropped off, and I'm just going to check and see if he came back. No, he didn't come back. Maybe he wanted to join us, and he had something he had to do today, and he couldn't, but hopefully he'll join us next week. But sometimes the human being has been led, and we know who's doing this leading. It's the Shaitan. We call him the devil or Shaitan. Sometimes the human being has been led to idolize and worship himself. The word idolize comes from the word idol. And an idol is a made-up god, a false god. In Hinduism, you have many idols. You know, I was just reading about this one idol that has the head of an elephant, you know, body of a human being, but has more than one set of arms. And people have them in their houses and in their temples, and it represents, you know, something. I can't go into the detail because I'm just beginning to learn about it. But these are idols. In the days of Pharaoh, he would erect these very, very, very tall statues, much, much taller than any human being. I seen them when I was in Egypt. They would be like two stories or three stories high, and people would worship them. They would be worshiping the idol, but the idol represented the power of the Pharaoh. But our misguided logic has led us to put our faith in things other than the Creator. So sometimes the human being has been led to idolize and worship himself. And when we trace the evolution of worship throughout the world, we can clearly see the path that man's struggling intellect has taken in search for the correct concept of God. And this understanding that we are reaching sometimes through our struggling intellect that is being fed by satanic misdirection causes us to think of many, many things instead of thinking correctly about the Creator as being the one that we should worship. But as we conclude, we have a very touching lesson that we are going to conclude with, that man comes to know the truth about God only through his divine revelation, which is brought to us by human messengers that are recipients of the revelation through the angels. We know of the angel Jibril, who revealed to the mother of Isa ibn Maryam, whose correct name was not even Isa, even though that's the Arabic, but he was not an Arab. He was a Palestinian Jew, according to history. And so he spoke Aramaic, which was a offshoot of Arabic, and he spoke Hebrew, and may have spoken a little Greek or maybe a little Latin, because the Romans were occupying Palestine, and some of the educated Romans also spoke Greek. But his native language was Hebrew, and in the Hebrew language, the name for this prophet, which we call Jesus, was Yahshua ben Maryam. And the angel Jibril appeared to Maryam, the mother of Yahshua, to let her know that she was going to bear this holy child that was going to be free from imperfection, and was going to be the spirit or the word of God to be giving the truth to the people about God, because they had been led astray. And so it was the truth that also came to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, the understanding of the real nature of God in relationship to the human being, that we are to come to the God expects the human being to come to him solely as slave servants. So this is how we know about God, through his messengers. And he has created a class of human messengers to be his intermediaries in carrying his message to the people. And these messages possess the best of human characteristics. And I'm going to close with this note. The Bible, as we know it, has been tampered with. It's been tainted and corrupted. And in order for people to justify their immorality, their human weaknesses, they ascribe sinfulness to many of the prophets. They say that David virtually committed murder, had one of his captains sent to the front lines where David knew this man was going to be killed so he could take over his wife. We have another story where the prophet Noah got drunk and he lusted after one of his daughters, and so forth and so on. But this is not true. God never appointed those kind of people to be his messengers. It says, and we'll close on this note, that they possessed the best of human characteristics. They weren't weak people. They weren't people that were sullied. They weren't people that were weak and corrupted. And they approached perfection as much as humanly possible. As much as humanly possible. We know that only Allah himself is perfect in every way. But as much as a human could be righteous and perfect and free from sinfulness, the messengers that God chose to bring his divine word to humanity were as perfect as a human being could be. They weren't like the stories we read about in the Bible. And that's why those of us who God has called, and I believe God calls some. He calls us all, he invites us all, but there's only a few people out of the masses that have been chosen to be given the work, to be given the job of being the examples for the people, because we have to make the sacrifice of not allowing our human appetites to direct our attention away from being as perfect as we can. We're never going to be perfect, but we have to constantly pray and strive that we can be the best examples. I remember, and I'll close with this note, my wife and I were having a discussion the other night, and I'm not ashamed to tell you the truth. And we were having a little bit of a disagreement about something. And I am not the most patient person in the world. That's one of the things I try to work on. And she said to me, she said, "You're supposed to be an imam, and yet your lack of patience is dominating this conversation." And I said, number one, I said, I'm not an imam if I'm not fulfilling the duty of an imam, which is to be a good example to you. So I need to get back in my role and be that leader for this household and be this example that I will be your imam. And that's what we have to do. Those of us that are in roles or responsible positions to lead communities, and those of us that are imams in our own homes, because we all can be an imam in our home, we should try to be the best example we can be. We may not be perfect, but we should strive to be as perfect as humanly possible, because God has given us the responsibility of being the leaders for our family, and in some cases for our communities. So we close with that note. We thank Allah for blessing us to have been given the strength. Given the strength, physical strength, and the moral and mental strength to come before you today. So at this time, we're going to turn the program over to our sister, Imam Brother Ali Hamza. And if you will, doing part of your response, help me to understand a little bit more about Hinduism, because it's important for me to be able to know these things, not just to complete this course successfully, but to understand the world around me. We have a lot of Hindus moving into this Augusta community, coming here as professionals in the medical field and other high-tech fields. And they're nice people. That's one thing I will say about the ones that I have come in contact with. They're very, 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 very nice people. And up at the university where I just retired, we have a lot of young participants or adherents to the Hindu culture. They have organized clubs. They have activities. They invite the rest of the students to come to their activities. They serve very delicious food. They're just some nice people, and I want to know what is it that they actually hold dear in terms of their beliefs. So maybe you can help me with that. So at this time, I turn over to Brother Assistant Imam Ali Hamza. Please go right ahead.
So go over the details on Hinduism, which will be a big topic, but I will just touch a few points. But before I do that, I had a couple of things that I wanted to mention that I came across recently, and I thought it would be good for the knowledge for the people who are listening to the program. But one of the things that I wanted to mention is that, you know, we will always have the strife in our religion, that people will always disagree. For instance, the Jews will never agree upon Jesus, peace be upon him, because their books closed and there is no mentioning of Isa alayhi salam, Jesus, peace be upon him. And the Christians will not believe in Prophet Muhammad because when their books closed and that's it, they don't look any further than that. So the only way to have unity or the oneness among the three religions is through the way of Islam, because as a Muslim, we accept all the prophets since the beginning. So the only way to remove this strife within the religions is by being a Muslim. By being a Muslim is by being a submitter to the will of God Almighty. Thing I wanted to mention, which is also something unique, I found that in Quran, Jesus, peace be upon him, Isa alayhi salam, is the only prophet who has been mentioned by the name of his mother. So if you read the Quran, it says about Jesus, Isa alayhi salam, and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala refers him to be as Isa ibn Maryam. So ibn, the word itself, is usually used to say the name of father afterwards. So, I mean, in the Arabic culture. But in Quran, if you read it, and whenever Isa alayhi salam's name is mentioned, so it's mentioned as Isa ibn Maryam. Instead of father's name, it has mother's name attached to it, which is very unique, which is, I think, was something great I wanted to share. Inshallah. Now I will move to the topic of Hindu. Yes, sir.
Yeah, before you go into that topic, Ali, I just want to share something with you. I think it's important at this point, before you go on to share this with you, I was just reading about this morning. The Quran, and I'll use my own words rather than the interpreters or the translators' words, but the Quran has different kinds of messages. Some are very direct. Like, for an example, when the Quran tells us that under certain conditions we are allowed to have up to 4 wives, if we fulfill the conditions, and I won't go into the details of the conditions, but it says it's better for you to only have one wife if you only knew. That's pretty clear. That's pretty straightforward. If you knew, in other words, what's better for you, what's going to be more in the long run, comfortable for your family life, it's better for you just to have one wife. It's pretty straightforward. But then it has other things that are considered to be allegorical. Without getting into a English grammar discussion, an allegory simply means a story. You have another word which means a story, which is a metaphor. But allegory is like what they call in the Christian religion a parable, which is a story that has another deeper meaning than just what's on the surface. What a lot of people, including the Muslims, don't, or some Muslims don't understand, is the story about Jesus is one of the most allegorical stories in not just the Quran, but in the Christian Bible as well. So to understand, and I'm not going to take over because I've done my little talk for the day, but I just want to say this, to understand the allegorical story of Jesus, we have to study the Arabic and we have to study the language. And one of the key things to unlocking the story is the word where it says that Jesus is the Khatima Allah. The Khatim means a word from Allah. So the word from and of basically have the same construction in the Arabic, the word Khatima Allah. And so he's the word from Allah, but he's the word of Allah. So if we understand that we're not talking about the physical, yes, Isa ibn Maryam was a physical person, but we're not now talking about a physical Maryam. We're not talking about a physical Yahshua or Isa. We're talking about a community, because Allah tells us in the Holy Quran, and Prophet Muhammad reemphasized it, that Allah's hand is over the community. And the community is the set, universal set of the believers. And Allah considers Maryam to be what is considered to be the mother of the community. So then we have to look at, well, what does Maryam actually mean? We're not talking about the 16-year-old, 17-year-old girl that got pregnant. And naturally, if you understand biology, you know that she had to have become impregnated by human sperm, and God don't, even though he creates sperm, he don't eject sperm. Never in the history have no sperm been ejected by a person that don't have no physical body. So we have to get out of that idea that the Christians have, that God, the Creator, entered into the womb or the vaginal canal of Mary, injected the sperm. That is totally absurd. So when we think of Mary now, we're not talking about a 16 or 17-year-old virgin. We're talking about a community of people that had the characteristics of Mary. So what does the Bible and the Quran say about Mary? Is that she was born free of sin, and her child was going to be born free of sin. So from the time that Mary was born, the devil, the Satan, was not able to have any influence over her. And then we look into the Quran, and I'm not going to keep on going. We could have more classes on this, and I'll tell you more about it. And so because her family could see that she was a special child, they did not want her to be influenced by the satanic influences that were even in that time in history pervading the community. And I've been to Israel. I've been to Nazareth, where Mary apparently came from. And I've been to Galilee. They got a big statue, about 20 feet high statue of Elvis Presley over there. And we know Elvis Presley represented in a certain way for the young people, a deviation from the strict morals of their family. That's why they wouldn't show the bottom part of his body when he was on the Ed Sullivan Show, because the gyrations were sexual gyrations. So they didn't want the young people to be corrupted. Eventually they did get corrupted. And that's in the place where Mary came from, where they had these same kind of influences going on over there then. So her family gave her, according to the story, to Zacharias, who was married to the cousin of Mary's mother. And this lady, her name was Elizabeth, according to the story, and Mary's mother was named Anna. And Zacharias was basically her cousin through marriage, and he was a priest, which had dedicated his life to serving God at the temple. And they asked Zachariah to take Mary and let her live in the temple. Well, women normally, unlike in the Greek culture, women didn't live in the temple. So he had a part of the temple add on, maybe a part of the temple where he left her. And it said angels fed her. Well, it wasn't necessary. Angels dropped bread and fruits in there. The angels were her teachers. It's like Gabriel came and taught her about the coming of Jesus, whether it was in dreams or whatever, I can't tell you, but the angels inspired her to keep her separated from the world. And that was the virginity, that she never became corrupted or indulged in the things of the world. But she couldn't have had a baby if she hadn't had the sperm of a man injected in her. That's just basic biology. But we'll get into some of these more deeper aspects of the religion later on. I don't want to lay all this out, you know, for our audience at one time. But there's so much, brother. Oh, my God. I thank God he blessed me over the last 50 years to have had teachers to take me out of the realm of what I call moonlight Islam. You know, when I went to the chapel, I call it our masjid on Fridays, our masjid. I'm not going to be wearing it all the time, but I had on a kufi, and it had a symbol. And some people call it a pagan symbol from back in the days of ancient Indians or the ancient Persians. But it's not really that. It's a symbol you see in the sky. The Persians and the Indians did not invent the sky, and they did not invent the symbol that you could see in the sky quite often, especially in the summertime and other times of the year as well, of the crescent moon and the star. But a crescent moon represents moonlight. Some say it represents the prophet reflecting the will of Allah. But the reflection that we see, sometimes because of the interpretations of some of these scholars, is not the deepest, clearest meanings of what the prophet represented. So we have the star, which actually represents sunlight, because every star is a sun, though we may not recognize all these stars because they're so far away as being suns, just like our star that we have that gives us light, and he is called the sun. So now we see the sun is rising in the west. And so those of us who come into Al-Islam, especially from birth, but not only from birth, but those of us who come into Al-Islam in the west, Allah has blessed us with the deeper teaching, because we are not stuck in just ritualistic understanding. I'll close by saying this, and then I'll ask you to continue with what you're going to say about the Hinduism. I remember when I was in Arabia many years ago, I traveled frequently to Arabia in my job that I had in the United States Navy. And I was staying in a very nice five-star hotel in Bahrain, which was at one time part of Saudi Arabia, and then one of the princes who wanted to have his own domain, his own dominion, asked his family if he could just have control as an emir over that island called Bahrain, and they granted him that, but it's really still technically part of Saudi Arabia if you look at it in terms of the fact that they're only separated by a little waterway, which is joined by a bridge. But I was there on Navy business, and I went outside to get a taxi to go to the Masjid in Manassa, which is the downtown area, because we were a little bit outside of district of Manassas. And I got into the cab, and the Arab cab driver, who looked to be in his 40s or 50s, I said, "Assalamu alaikum." And he said, "Wa alaikum assalam." And we rode for a few minutes. And he says, because I guess he was wondering, because he could tell, and I asked him to take me downtown, I said it in English. And even though I looked like I could have been from Egypt, he had questions about who I was and where I was coming from. He said, "Are you a Muslim?" I said, "Yes, sir." He looked at me a little quizzically. He said, "Do you read the Quran?" I said, "Yes, sir. I read it every single day." He said, "I read it, but I don't understand it." Now, this man was Arab. He spoke English, and he could read the Quran in English. But see, they don't teach them to understand the Quran. They teach them to recite it. They can recite it beautifully. They have the madrasas where they teach the children from the time they're 6 or 7 years old, maybe younger, to recite the Quran. But they don't teach them to understand it. See, I was blessed because I came up in a situation where my teacher understood the Quran. He wasn't an Arab. He was an African-American who had been taught by some of the more wiser sheikhs that did understand the Quran. Now, why they won't let these people over there teach the general population the real understanding of the Quran, I think a lot of it has to do with the politics. Because if people understand the Quran, they're not going to be enslaved by kings and emirs and people in the government. They're not going to allow that to happen. They're going to say, "La ilaha illallah, Muhammad Rasulullah," and that's the way it's going to stay. And they're not going to be bowing down and walking backwards when they come in contact with some leader, because they think that leader is the most powerful person in the world. So maybe that's the reason why they don't teach it. But I'm not in a situation like that, because here in America, I was able to be taught. And so some of the things, and I'm not saying this to put any kind of star in my crown, but I'm saying this because it's my responsibility. It's my responsibility. I never asked to be the imam at Fort Gordon. Never once did I ever ask to be the imam at Fort Gordon. I was assigned to that role by an imam. And I stayed on that job for 21 years, never once asking anybody to make me be the imam except two times. And I didn't ask to be the imam. I said, I want you to vote for the person you want to be the imam out of all the people here. And it's about 35 people in the room, and most of them were from different countries. They were here for officer training from different countries. We had a couple from the United States. And they said, we want you to be continue to be the imam. And I said, if you that's what you want, I will do it. Then it got to a point to where I said, you know, it was burdening me to have to be an imam and then still having to give recognition in a military way to the military authorities. You know, if something happened and they didn't like it, like an imam I invited did something they didn't like, then they called me in and then they wanted to make me feel like I did something wrong. And just because I didn't know what the brother was going to say and what he said was embarrassing to the commander, to the chaplain. I said, you know, I really don't need this. But you know what? I was not able to get out of it. I told him I was retiring. They said, you've done a wonderful job. They gave me the United States Army Commander's Public Service Medal. But I couldn't stop doing what I did. I was still giving the goodbyes. I was still the one that they called if they had problems. I never was able to leave the position. And then when the COVID started and they said we couldn't have the program at the chapel anymore, I did not get the word that we could come back because I had all this junk mail and I missed the message. And when I finally had a brother call me and tell me that he'd been over there and they had moved it, we'd been over in Friendship Chapel, but they'd moved it to where we could come back over there. I went back over there and Chaplain Bowley, I think his name is, he's getting ready to leave now. He said, I'm so glad to see you. You need to be back on the job because some issues have come up and we need for you to be back on the job so I don't have to deal with some of these problems. I said, I will be back on the job. He said, well, if you want to be retired again, you can. As soon as I find somebody, I say, I will never, and God willing, I'll never retire again, but I never asked for the job. But since I have the job, I have the responsibility to share all the knowledge that I have. So what I told you about Jesus, that person you're talking about in the Jesus is not the physical person that was born from that 16, 17-year-old girl. That's talking about a community. And if you see it in that light, then you understand what the virgin birth means, a community that's based on pure, undiluted, uncorrupted truth from the word of God, and that's why he's called a Katamala. So let me go ahead and stop now, and I'll talk about this more in the future. And, brother, I'd like for you to please help me out at this time with whatever you can share about the Hinduism and what they actually do believe. Thank you.
Yes, brother. So, again, me coming from a Hindu family, right, in the past, the problem is that Hinduism, as you had mentioned, does not have a set following, like, hey, this is the standards, these are the principles, this is what you follow, this is what you believe in, this makes you Hindu. Now, in terms of Hinduism, every person could have their own personal set of principles or the things that they believe in. And the books that they follow, it's not one book, there are many books. So in today's society and the people I know and the way I grew up, nobody ever read any book on Hinduism. We would have books at home, which we will call holy books. There were many, but nobody would read it, neither my parents. I've never seen my grandparents read it. And, of course, we never read it either. So the basic idea of Hinduism is, in my family at least, was what we grew up seeing around us. So if I when I was born, I saw, like, okay, there's a religious festivity or something is happening at home, and there's some preparations going on, food is being made, and then the idols are placed, and they call a priest to come over to the house to commence the religious part of it, because nobody has the religious knowledge to be able to do it themselves. So they got to hire another person to do it for them. And the reason behind that goes back in the old times, when the society in India was created based upon the class system. And the class was determined by based upon your profession. And based upon your profession, you landed somewhere in the class system and you were treated accordingly. So the people who were supposed to be the top of the class, they were called the Brahmins, were the ones who created the class system, who created the caste system, caste and the class. So it's a political thing. You know, I see it as, and a lot of people agree, that they did it so that they could keep themselves on the top and they will dominate the entire society, whatever. So they did not let anybody else have knowledge, because they were the only ones responsible to educate themselves and teach others who needed it based upon their class. So that's why they were always treated as, like, you know, always had money, always had everything. So the knowledge was never really transferred completely 100% down the other classes. So which we will see today too, that the Hinduism that people are born into these days is the Hinduism that they see around them, that actually has very little to do with what has been written in the books. And the books that I have read, few of them, that basically are written by the individuals or the saints or the people of the time who would not write it as the word of God, but they were writing it as sort of a story about God. So, like, you know, in Quran, in Bible, in Torah, when we read about the word of God. But in Hinduism, when we read their books, it's very rare we find we find the stories, but they have made them more into, like, they would make it seem like more like a fairy tale. So now, when I was growing up, I personally didn't really saw anybody reading any kind of book or telling me something from a book. Hey, you know, on chapter this and verse number that, God has instructed us to do this. It was no such reference I ever came across from nowhere. So that was my personal thing. You know, I'm not saying that that's how the real Hinduism is. The real Hinduism, I think, I'm sure everybody has to go back to their books and read, which nobody is doing it these days anyways. So, and even when I asked my parents, when they were upset that, hey, you know, you chose the way of Islam, which is totally opposite of the way that we practice, you know. So I told them, like, hey, you know, if you want to talk about religion, let's do it this way. Let you go back to your books and read from it and come back, and I'll read from my book, and I come back, and we can have a nice discussion of what we find. So this way, you get educated on your religion, and I get a chance to educate myself more in Islam. So the problem was that they are basically forced to believe into something, and it's more like, you know, the same concept where, you know, I don't want to change the way my forefathers were living their lives. It's like a generational thing. I don't want to make that change type of thing. So they're not comfortable, even though they might not know anything about it. They might not be able to talk about it. Because whenever they have to do something religiously, they just hire a priest, and that priest comes to their home and does all the ceremonies. So, again, the details of what I have read, it's mostly, when I come across it, I see it as sort of fairy tales. And there were some good political and ideological discoveries that had been made by certain individuals of their time, that they have adapted some of those principles in the religion itself. But a lot of the stuff that, if they go for real Hinduism, was really, really backwards as well. For instance, they had, like, you know, like we, like in the Arabs, there was a practice about killing a female child. When the female child was born, the Hindus had a practice of sati system. Sati system was, if a husband of a woman were to die for various causes, the woman, being a widow, has to basically die along with the husband. She has to sacrifice herself. She can no longer be allowed to live. So they had, back in the days, too. So those practices were heavily criticized when British were the one ruling India. And they tried to educate people at that time to tell them that these are very barbaric practices and they need to be stopped. And eventually there were some people who, you know, did more research into Hinduism. And amongst their own religion people, they educated people saying, hey, this is not something that God would want to happen. So things like that, you know, there was to be practiced a lot, which no one talks about it these days, you know, when they talk about Hinduism. But, you know, when I say Islam actually talks about the rights of the widow, the rights of a female. You know, anything that was unfair in the society were justified and corrected in Quran. Whereas in Hinduism, you don't really get to see those things. It's more sort of, I don't know if that's because of the religious text that does it, but it's more because of people who took control of the society and they dictated and they designed the religion to cater to their own needs who were dominating the society at that time. So Hinduism, again, has a caste system where, you know, they don't treat everybody equally. If you come from a lower caste, you're not allowed into the temples of the higher caste people, or you're not allowed in the societies to come in, you're not allowed to come to the parties, you cannot go to the same schools, you cannot hang out with the same people. So there's a lot of discrimination based upon caste and the class in Hinduism. And this is so deeply rooted that even today we get to see it. When I travel to India, you know, and I see it all the time. There will be certain class who is responsible for cleaning the filth or dirt from the streets and collecting the garbage. That there will be a caste who is only responsible for farming, and they don't do anything else because they don't get opportunity to do anything else because society is designed to stop them. And then there will be a caste who is only doing businesses. They're not doing anything other than that. So things like that, you know, that still is deeply rooted into the mindset of the people, and it kind of belittles, you know. Like, you know, I also have friends in high school when I was back in India, I was in school, and I would not know, you know, I didn't learn this, because what I personally believe is nobody is born racist. Nobody is born to discriminate. If you put a child next to another child, doesn't matter what color, what race it comes from, the child would not know the difference. It's the parents who teaches the child. So the racism comes from the family, from the environment that we grow up in. So in India, when I was a kid, when I had friends, I made friends regardless of who they were. I didn't know that I shouldn't be making friends with the person who's lower class or caste than me, or I shouldn't be sitting with the Muslims. I didn't know. I would eat their food. They would eat with me. They would sit with them. So one day I invited some of my friends to my house, and my family took an offense to it. They were like, how dare you invite these people to the house? I was like, what do you mean by these people? And then they described me later that who these people are. And I was shocked, because until then I didn't know anything as such. Because I was probably in like seventh grade at that time. I was too young to probably exposed to such ideas, but I didn't know that I'm not supposed to make friends among certain kind of people. So I disagreed with my family at that time. I told them that, hey, I do not think that they are like that the way you're explaining. But they tried to push their ideology on me by saying, hey, you have to accept it. This is how it is. This is how society is. This is how it works. And I disagreed, and I never listened to them on that. I pretended, yeah, you're right. You know, when I went back to school, I never felt those people feel any different. So that kind of concept is deeply rooted within the people. And, yes, I'm not saying everybody's like that. There are people whom I've met who were very open and very understanding about certain things. But they might not say it because, you know, like when we live in America, right, in America, society is different. Society is, you know, at least the law dictates us that we cannot discriminate based upon various things. But in India, there's no such thing. Even if there is, there's not really something that's going to enforce that law. So to see the real side of any religion, how it is practiced, we have to travel to the place where it originated from to see that how they treat the minorities. And it doesn't only apply to Hinduism, it applies to Islam too. And I say the same things to Muslims. I say, hey, you know, the Islamic countries where the Muslims are dominating and the other religions are minorities, they're not treated well. And same thing happens in India too. India is dominated by Hindus. So every other religion is a minority, so they don't treat them well either. But in America, everybody has to treat each other the way, you know, the law defines, so they have no choice. They have to put aside their personal beliefs within themselves do the right thing. But you have to see the truth by traveling to India, how actually they treat people over there. And not just to the minority in terms of other religions. They treat their own religion people, but treat them differently based upon their caste and the class. So this is the basic of the religion. And another thing is that every household that I went to, like my friend's house, right, they were all Hindus at that time. And I would go and they will have a different set of gods that I have never heard of before. And I'm like, what is it that you're praying? They're like, oh, this is our family goddess or family god or something. There will be common gods that everybody believes in, and then there will be personal gods that they only believe in, only that family or the group of people believe in. So I was like, okay, these are too many gods. You go from North India to South India, the gods will change. You go from South India to Western India or Eastern India, the gods will change, the temples will change, the language will change, the culture will change, the traditions will change, the dressing styles will change. There's too much going on. So I was like, okay, this is too complicated. There's not a solid one foundation that everybody will come to agreement on. Yes, they agree on the basic certain things, but then they also have their own sect, and it's all over the place. There are probably like thousands of gods. So for me, it was a very complicated system and really hard to keep track of. It's not one thing that someone would agree with. So I told my family, hey, you know what? You want to convince me, you got to come up with something solid, something that you believe in, and try to, you know, educate yourself and come back with it to try to tell me, like, hey, this is what's, and show me where it's written. Don't just say it, show me. Because you're saying it because your parents told you something and their parents told them something. So it's just passing off the knowledge to the generation, and it's like a filtration. So you now, at this point, you're not pitching me the religion anymore. You're pitching me your ideas. So that's where the problem about Hinduism and me not tricking is. And I didn't agree with the discrimination part. And it's deeply rooted, no matter how much people pretend. I've seen it personally. And I know people. I know the castes, both kind. And I've spoken to both sides' families, and they talk bad about each other. They say, oh, they are the higher class people. They will never accept us, never treat us equally, which is true. And I've seen that. So what I'm saying is that any religion that divides people, that creates discrimination, that creates belittling bigotry, or undermines the right of the citizens, especially the females. You know, Islam, people will see it in a negative manner, saying, hey, you know, you Muslims, you know, force your women to cover, do hijab, and do all that. Only if they knew, only if they read the Quran and see what's written in terms of the rights of the women, you know, then they will understand the truth, which not a lot of religions talk about. Hinduism doesn't even talk about it. In Hinduism, women is seen only as an object, as a symbol. And that the object, I'll give you an example, and then I'll close, because this is going to be otherwise a big discussion. So there were used to be these saints that they would meditate to convince God to give them what they wanted. So, for example, back in the days, the Hinduism belief was that if you wanted something from God, you have to meditate for years, and then God will be convinced because of your sincerity, and the God will appear to you, and God will grant you what you wanted. So the people would do that for years, and what God would do is to test them, they would send them distractions. And distractions in the form of women, beautiful women who will try to seduce these men to break their meditation, to distract them from their meditation so that God wouldn't have to grant them what they're looking for. And I see it in every story that I've came across in Hinduism, whatever they call it, like those stories about God and great men and kings and whatever. All of them always rolled around a female. So I was like, okay, what is this going on? So woman is only shown as a symbol of, as an object, a sexual thing. That's it. There's no respect in there. And the kings will have hundreds of wives. They will have hundreds of female servants. And this is true. If you look at the Indian history of the kings, that's what they did. They would drink, they'll spend a lot of money, and they will have a lot of queens, and on the side they will have a lot of other female servants that they will use it for however they need it. And there is no checking on them. There is no saying anything against them. And that had been rooted in the culture. So I was like, okay, so where is the decency in this? Where are you showing me decency in this? So when I'm looking at a religion, I'm looking at what I'm learning from it. What am I teaching to the kids? Going to a temple, praying to a statue or an idol, is that what the religion is teaching? This is the only limitation. Or it's giving me some principles that I carry forward and become a better person. I'm sure there is a lot more than what I described about Hinduism. But as I said, there are so many books, and nobody reads the books. And even the books that we read, they're not straightforward. They're very complicated because a lot of them are written in ancient language of Sanskrit. So you have to find, of course, a translation, and then which one to read from, you know, that pertains to your need or what you want to learn about. It's hard. So that's the problem in Hinduism, because it has become such a complicated religion that people just literally following after whatever they see it on them. And that's what the Hinduism for that person. And then whoever the next person will be, whatever he sees it on himself, that's what he would think of Hinduism is, and that's what he's going to practice, and that's what he's going to enjoy. And that's going to get embedded in him, and that's what he's going to transfer. And that's what has happened to my family, at least in my personal example. So in details of books and all that, and comparison of Islam, I can probably do it in some other time, but that's what I want to give in for now. Brother, back to you.
Okay, well, thank you so very much. We're just about at we are at the end of our time. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, brother.
Just a minute. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and finish with our tradition of closing. And thank you so much for that information. It's very helpful to me, and look forward to next week when you will be the host speaker for the Talim, and also giving you a little double duty, if it's okay, if you don't prefer to do it this way. But since you weren't able to give the goodbye yesterday, I'd like to ask you if you will give the goodbye to us on next Friday, because I know you had prepared. I know you always prepare, so I know you prepared something. But yesterday, so if you could deliver that on next Friday and also be our host for the Tyler, you don't have to continue in this light on this particular subject. I'm going to try to get in touch with Brother Angel and Brother Layman, and hopefully there'll be some others that come out on Friday, and both you and myself can announce about the Talim on Sunday. I will pass out, or you can help me pass out for whoever's there, some of my business cards that have my phone number, so only thing they have to do is just send me a text, and I will send them the number to call in. I think the next set of cards that I'm going to order, I will put the actual number for the Talim on the card in addition to my own personal number. And that way they won't have to send me a text to get the number. They'll have the number right there. I put the time of the Talim and the number to call. So I thank you so much, Brother, Sister Imam Muhammad, Brother Ali Muhammad Hamza. And we will close at this time. Did you want to add anything else before we close?
No, brother, that's it. You can go ahead.
Okay. All right. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wassalatu wassalamu ala Rasulihi al-Kareem. All praise is due to Allah, the Lord of all of the worlds. The prayers and the peace be upon his generous messenger. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wassalatu wassalamu ala Rasulina Muhammadin wa ala alihi wasabi ajma'in. All praise is due to Allah, the Lord of all the worlds. The prayers and the peace be upon Messenger Muhammad, and upon his most noble companions, all of them. So again, we thank you, Brother Assistant Imam Ali, and we thank all who may have wanted to come on today, but were unaware that we had resumed. But your intention counts for a lot with Allah. And so we thank Allah for that intention, and we hope that we will be able to get information to everyone for next Talim, the next Circle of Islamic Knowledge on Sunday. So thank you very much. And at this time we close, and we always like to close with the beautiful sound of Al-Fatiha. We'll go ahead now. We'll do that, inshallah. Praise be to Allah.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim.
Alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen. Ar-Rahmanir rahim. Maliki yawmiddin. Iyyaka na'budu wa iyyaka nasta'in. اهدنا الصراط المستقيم صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين.